There are two things I always tell you. One is that the silence is the story. And the other one is that you always have to figure out who the beneficiary is of a story, especially a story about Madigan buddy Mike McLean writing an email about protecting a Democrat because he covered up a rape and kept quiet about Jones's ghost payrollers and all the rest. And you gotta wonder, who's the beneficiary? Who's the beneficiary when Mike Madigan goes? Because it's happening. They told him, his friends, they said, Mike, you've got more money than, you know, Bloomberg. Why don't you retire? And he just never wanted to retire. Eddie Burke the same way, Alderman Ed Burke. Millions of dollars. Millions. They never wanted to retire. You know why? If they retired, they'd just be two old Irishmen with money. Two old Southwest Siders with money. And who would care at Palermo's on 95th if you're just a guy with money? But when you're Speaker of the House, when you're Alderman of the 14th Ward, then you've got clout. You have status. And so they stayed too long. Ed Burke has been indicted, though not convicted, in the operation, you know, the big operation, whatever it is, Uncle Rico, I call it, driving the bus. Mike Madigan hasn't been charged, but the pressure's building. So who is the beneficiary? I'll tell you who. There's a possibility. Think of them outside a hamburger store, you know, like one of those hamburger franchises. He's wearing a little kind of paper hat. He's holding out that big boy hamburger, big boy cheeseburger, Governor Big Boy. Governor Big Boy is going to be the beneficiary because Governor Big Boy, Governor Pritzker, has all the money in the world. He'll buy the Democratic Party. Some of his people, he's not criticizing Madigan, but some of the people that he funded are. Mike Madigan knows this. It's all a big game. You should know it too. One thing we don't do enough, talk about the agendas behind the players. I've always done that. And we're going to talk to Jason Meisner of the Chicago Tribune about this and other things. And later, Tom Bevin of Real Clear Politics, the co-founder, president of Real Clear Politics, that wonderful site that you can get all sorts of op-eds, left and right, and the Real Clear Politics average of polls. Joining me, as always, co-host and my friend, newly engaged, Jeff Carlin, the executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN, but also the intended of the lovely Christine Fiedler. And I'm John Kess, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune and member of its editorial board, still waiting for Governor Big Boy and Madigan and Burke and the rest of them to tell me, stay in Illinois. We're going to fix this thing. Because I know that they fixed it. And you know where you are? With all these politicians and the populism rising on the left and the populism on the right and Madigan and McLean. You're on the Chicago way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
And like I told you, when you read bylines, you read stories in the newspapers, you take a note of the bylines. Some people are, you know, off the rails, and other people are reasonable, fair, and just and good reporters. And one of them, I think one of the finest reporters in all of Chicago, is on the phone with us now, Jason Meisner of the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Jace.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
So what's going on with Madigan? Give us the Madigan update.
Speaker Madigan and his iron grip in Springfield, everyone is jumping on the bandwagon saying he's slipping. And the weak link so far has been this Michael McLean, his longtime confidant, friend, ComEd lobbyist, former lawmaker. They go back to the 70s, his friends and lawmakers. So WBEZ filed a Freedom of Information Act request for Michael McLean's emails and unearthed one from July 2012, where he made references to covering up rape in Champaign, both payrolling and just fueling speculation about what the heck he was talking about. So that's the latest.
Oh, just another day in Springfield. This story, when it came out, you saw the headline and obviously happened to fellows over at BEZ. This story, I mean, we've been following this, obviously. You've, Jason, been all over this. Lots of reporters have been all over this in town, but you guys have been kind of leading the way in a lot of this. But this unraveling of this investigation into the Madigan machine, Uncle Rico rolling the bus up, and it really felt like it wasn't until this headline hit that all of a sudden the general populace is taking notice. And unfortunately, I think it's because of that, the rape word. I mean,
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we've been writing about this. We broke the story that Mike McLean's house had been raided. It was raided in May. We didn't find out about it for a few weeks. I think we wrote that story in June or July. Then came the news that the feds had been listening in on his phone calls. And we also reported on, you know, that this whole kind of shadow lobbying practice that was being run, that's the focus of the federal investigation. So it's been coming out in dribs and drabs. But it wasn't until it's four words in an email from 8 years ago, the rape in Champaign, and that's what has blown up. It has, as far as I know, it has nothing to do with what the feds are looking at, but it certainly is interesting and shocking, and it deserves investigation, and that's what's going on now. On Saturday, the Tribune broke Ray Long and David Heinzman, who've been following up on this email ever since WBEZ published it last week. They've disclosed that it may not be exactly what a lot of people thought. I think people read those words, the rape in Champaign, and they immediately thought, oh my gosh, this is a cover-up of a felony of rape at the highest levels of state government. And that somebody has gotten away with rape, essentially, because of this cover-up. And now what's come out is what they may be looking at is this serial sexual offender who was released early under a controversial program by then Governor Pat Quinn, went on to sexually abuse a young girl after he'd been released early, and he was arrested and convicted of that too. So there was the crime itself wasn't covered up. It was the politics, the fallout from that they were trying to keep quiet, not the rape itself.
I've been covering politics, I think, and I didn't hear any political blowback or talk about Governor Quinn's Michael Dukakis moment, where the early release of a felon leads to a sexual offender, leads to another sexual attack. I didn't hear anything. So, in a way, it was covered up, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I didn't cover that race, but I know, you know, Ray Long did, and he did report that at the time Quinn's opponents were hammering him on this issue, so and it almost cost him the election. He ended up winning, of course, but an issue like a specific case like this, explosive, where it's a young girl who's the victim, it's a guy who obviously had previous similar convictions in his past and was let out early, so yeah, it could have been a bombshell if it had come out then.
But it wasn't, and Quinn was elected, and his, you know, he's been telling people, as you know, Jason, I don't know anything about this McLean thing, the McLean thing, is he going to cooperate?
Well, McLean, he was approached by Dan Meopoulos and Dave McKinney last week they found him eating at Chicago Cut, having a nice lunch at one of Chicago's premier steakhouses, which is not the kind of place you go to if you don't want people to see you. So I thought it was interesting that he was there. But having lunch, they approach him outside, ask him that question, you know, have the feds asked you to cooperate? And he said yes. Later, a source of ours confirmed that, yes, they did. They did approach him, which is kind of, you know, you would expect that they would have. That's what they do. They approach you. They say, look, we've got information on you, and we need you to cooperate, or you could be in big trouble. He claims that he has refused to. So that's where that's at. They did approach him, and there's only really one reason they would, and that's to cooperate against his friend, Michael Madigan. So that investigation continues. No one has been charged. McClain hasn't been charged. None of the ComEd people who are involved in that whole situation have been charged, and we are waiting to see how this all shakes out.
Yes, the ComEd thing is one thing that's bedeviling Michael Madigan, although I'm interested. I guess we'll find out if and when charges are filed and there's a trial. To what extent did Ann Pramaggiore actually run the lobbying effort, or were there some other people running the lobbying effort at Exelon who may know Michael Madigan and McClain? But I think all that right now is, you know, that moment before trial or before a big indictment, there's a lot of behind the scenes stabbing, isn't there? In the kidneys, in the liver, in the spine, with short little knives in the shadows. And sometimes we hear about, you know, we see the glint of the steel as it goes in. So we report about it. But there's always agendas to be played here from people that may not have been charged yet. And I wonder, as you know, Jason, you know how this works, but to let our listeners in, how do you balance all that as a journalist?
It can get difficult. I'm not a political reporter. In my career, I focus mostly on court, where, you know, information is down on paper, or you're in court hearings where testimony is under oath. When you get into this realm where no one's been charged yet, it's all going, a lot of it's going on behind the scenes. It is extremely difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff and figure out, you know, what's this guy's angle? What is he working? It's now been 4 months since the feds raided Martin Sandoval's offices. Almost 4 months. It'll be 4 months at the end of this month. So what's going on there? And that is a lot of time for people to be maneuvering and talking, who's cooperating, who's not. And so you do have to be careful about what's coming from where.
And I'm still wondering, with respect to Sandoval and the red light cameras, when the rest of the media will realize that the Exelon vice president, who may have been in charge ultimately of lobbying, Mr. Von Haney, who has not been charged or accused and hinted at any crime, top lawyer, former prosecutor, now with Exelon, and he's married to Nikki Zoller, the red light camera boss, who was that company was involved somehow with Mr. Sandoval. I wonder how that's all going to shake out, or if it does, and if people ever put those. I know you've put those pieces of yarn together on the crisis board or whatever we call it, you know, from Homeland on HBO. Is it Showtime?
Showtime, yeah.
Showtime. I find it odd that it doesn't become a story. The relationship between
in these cases, it's amazing to me. Just when you think, you know, it couldn't get any weirder, there's always a connection somewhere. And yes, Nikki Zoller is married to the top Exelon executive, who also was, I believe, represented Hanhart at one point.
He represented Angelini, and I re-quoted a Tribune quote, I think. Maybe you had gotten the original quote on that. Did you write the original story on the Wizard of Oz, the mafia bookmaker? Was that you?
No, that was not. I think that might have been my editor, Matt O'Connor, but that was before my time.
And Jason, one of my favorite stories of the past week or so that Jason's had his hands on is the story of the pastor or reverend. I don't even know what you'd call it. I mean, they're self-titling themselves, but with got a
man of God.
Yeah, man of God. There you go. And spending God's money, if you will, that was supposed to go to the needy on Bentleys. Is that, can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, the Reverend Pastor Clarence Smith Jr. Runs a church on West Cermak in Lawndale, and he was he's a convicted felon. Years ago he ripped off an elderly man's estate by forging signatures and collected about $100,000 that wasn't his. He gets some jail time in DuPage, and then most recently he was running this church and collecting a lot of money through this federal grant, administered by the state, but it's a federal grant, federal dollars, that's supposed to, you know, they feed hungry children in the neighborhood, then they build a state. Well, he was allegedly vastly overstating how many children he was feeding, and he collected over $1 million and went out and bought a Bentley, $142,000 cashier's check in the suburbs. Which, why that didn't raise eyebrow, I guess, you know, if he shows up with a cashier's check, you don't ask any questions. So he's been charged federally, but he's still actively preaching online and inviting people to worship. He keeps vaguely mentioning, you know, like, we must atone for our sins, and nobody's perfect, and I need to be a better man. So he's like, he's vaguely referencing his own issues.
That's the Chicago way.
Is he using a public defender? Is he paying for his own? I guess you can't
He's got his own lawyer who never called me back. He reached out to me. The pastor did and said, "Well, my lawyer's going to call you," but of course he never called. But I did put in my story that this is not the first time that I've covered a pastor charged with stealing from a program and buying a Bentley. It's actually the second. There was a guy at Cicero, a preacher, who did almost the exact same thing. It was a different program, but also bought himself a Bentley. So there's some kind of precedent going on here in Chicago.
From the same dealership?
You know, that's a good question. I didn't go back
that's
and check
to question.
See where he got his Bentley.
I got to call Jimmy DeLeo and see if he's, you know, if his old Bentleys are showing up in the...
I was buying those
Bentleys, Jimmy. Yeah. All right, Jason, in closing, what do you see coming soon, if anything?
We were hearing before Christmas, and I'm sure you were too, or, I mean, everybody was kind of on pins and needles. They were going to wrap some things up at a bow before the holidays. I had heard possibly the stake speed investigation, they were going to take that down. But it's been very quiet, and now the holidays are over, everyone's back, still crickets. So something's going on, like we were talking about before. Somebody might be cooperating. That cooperation leads them in a new direction. So you never know, but we are expecting at some point within the next few weeks, some things are going to go public. We will see some charges brought. I can't say against who, but and then the ComEd investigation, I get the sense that's farther out. I'm not quite sure how far down the road they are on that one, but it's the suburban investigations involving Sandoval and those mayors, Tobolsky and Getty. They seem to be much closer in bringing that one to a close, so stay tuned.
We have to tell listeners, you had come out to the southwest suburbs out in McCook with me. We had we had nice asabuco, didn't we, or something? What did we have at JC's pub?
The odor kept, you know, bringing us things to try, and I think by the time we got to ordering the asabuco, we were too full. I don't think we had that.
We were too full, and we didn't. Yes, that's right. They were really good from Joe, and we did, of course, pay. You know, because we're not bloggers in Springfield. We're actually reporters for the Chicago Tribune. But then we wanted to go to the cigar store that the feds have lit up, and we couldn't make it because Jason had to pick up his the kids And someday,
she's like, if I got caught hanging out at the cigar lounge, late to take care.
You smell,
I'd be in big trouble.
You smell like cigars, and you didn't pick up the kids on time. That would be, But I guess I'll try to go back there, Jason, and let you know what happens. I hope I don't get rounded up in the big federal bus, you know, if they take all the cigar smokers there. But if they do, I hope I can rely on you to vouch for me as a character witness.
Of course.
Jason Meisner, Chicago Tribune, one of the best, if not the best, reporters in town. Read the bylines. Follow him on Twitter at
JMETR22B.
Jason Meisner, thanks, buddy.
Thanks a lot, John.
Everybody is to leave here immediately. This cafe is closed until further notice. Clear the room at once.
How can you close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked, to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Feel spring, feel the power come inside. This will be the year, more time you can do.
And now on the Chicago Way, one of my oldest friends, the founder, co-founder, and president of the greatest website, Real Clear Politics. You can find politics, political averages, polling averages, history, science. I mean, it's just great. And in on the front page, it the points of view alternate. So it's not all right. It's not all left. It's just what a town square should be, where people come with their opinions. And our guest, Tom Bevin, is the man behind it. Good day to you.
Good morning, John.
So what do we expect from the Democratic field as we proceed into this next phase of electing a president?
Stuff is about to get real, right? We've been pontificating about who's up and who's down and who's support and all this stuff. But in 3 weeks, the first real vote is going to be cast by Democrats in the Iowa caucuses. And that's when I think we're going to see just who has support, who doesn't, who beats expectations, who falls short of expectations. And I think all of those calculations will affect the race moving forward. I mean, we really have seen, though, over the last couple of weeks, Bernie Sanders has really strengthened his position as Elizabeth Warren has fallen off. And Bernie's taken a much more aggressive stance. He's hitting Joe Biden on his Iraq war vote. He's hitting Elizabeth Warren as being a candidate of the quote-unquote elite. He's been hitting Pete Buttigieg, and his plan is saying that it's been tried and failed. So Bernie is sort of feeling his oats a little bit here, which is pretty surprising given the fact that he was just, you know, a couple of months ago was in the hospital after having had a heart attack. So it's been quite a rebound for him. I think he's in a pretty strong position right now, and we'll see whether that holds up over the next few weeks.
Only 3 years ago or less, the Republican Party began to implode. It was something some people, I have to say, I thought of it, and you did too, where the Bush years, the war, wars in Iraq, and et cetera, were just too much for the center to bear, and the reaction of the base vote was so anti-war, and everything began to collapse on the Republican side. It fell apart, and who picked up the pieces and moved into the vacuum? Donald Trump. And now we're seeing that same type of center collapsing with Joe Biden on, you know, the, I guess, centrist, whatever that means, on the Democratic side. He's just not doing it. And Bernie Sanders, to me, is rising. And he seems to be, in my mind, reflecting the mood of the Democratic Party as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Look, the Democrats, this is what primaries are for. They're hashing this out to see the sort of moderate, you know, as you said, moderate, whatever that means these days, wing of the party versus the more progressive liberal wing of the party. And certainly, you know, a lot of Democrats like to say their party is still more moderate than progressive. But the progressives is where all the energy and enthusiasm is. It's where the dollars are. It's where the crowds are. You know, Joe Biden he's raising okay money, but not great. Certainly not like Bernie. He's getting okay crowds, not great. And so that's the reason you've got Michael Bloomberg sort of waiting in the wings although Michael Bloomberg is not going to excite anybody to jump out of their chair.
Well, that's not true. He did excite Judge Judy. Judge Judy jumped out of her robe for him, so there you go.
Yeah, and I read that at their kickoff event after she endorsed him, they had 45 people at the event in Iowa. So I don't think Judge Judy's endorsement is a silver bullet for Michael Bloomberg. But look, back to John's original point. It is interesting to see how quickly these things can change. You remember after Barack Obama was elected, it was on the cover of Time magazine. The Republican Party is finished. They're the Whigs. They're a rump party of the South, you know, never to be in a majority again. And literally the next election that took place in New Jersey and Virginia governorships, they won over independents. They ended up, winning back the House. And then along comes Donald Trump, who remakes the Republican Party in his image in about, I don't know, over the course of 18 months or so. And in doing that has really scrambled the political calculus in this country of not only the policies from a, you know, Republican orthodoxy on free trade, on foreign policy, those sorts of issues. But Democrats are now scrambled as well, trying to figure out how do they win back those voters? How do they, excite all the different factions of their party, their minority voters and all of that? And it's going to be interesting to see this play out. I mean, it's quite possible they nominate someone who fits the mood of the moment, which is a Bernie Sanders. And it's a repeat of, 1968 and 72. You know, you go from Humphrey to McGovern and it's a wipeout. Or it could be the opposite. I mean, we just don't know how this is going to play out. I think the political situation in this country, for especially on the Democratic side right now, is very, very fluid.
We don't know how it will be a McGovern-Nixon. You know, we don't know.
We don't.
Because, and I just think that Bernie is the authentic Democrat for his time right now, where the party is, where the base of the party is. Elizabeth Warren, remember the New York Times had that piece in its magazine a few months ago where she shows up with all the big fat cat donors and says, "Hey, I'm really not a revolutionary. I'm one of you." And Bernie's pounding that. Buttigieg, I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, I think sometimes if the mannequin from the Mishawaka men's store type of thing, I don't see the questionably fourth mayor of Indiana running the country, but he does because he's gay. He has that, he did get kind of a boost up on the intersectionality highway at the beginning. Maybe Amy, what's her name? Klobuchar.
Yeah.
You know, she's running what, third? I mean, that's one of the reasons why Real Clear Politics, I think, is so important. Everybody refers to it, and when all these news stations of all over the country say, the RCP polling average, do you get, you get anything besides another pair of wings? What do you get for that when they keep...
No, it's good for traffic. It's good for the brand. I mean, to have the RCP averages cited as the authority on, the current state of the race nationally and in some of these early states, I mean, that's huge for us and for our brand. But to your point, John, I mean, the latest folks to drop out, you had Julian Castro and Cory, but when Kamala Harris dropped out, Cory Booker had said, they're complaining, it's just all white people on the stage, all white people. Elizabeth Warren, actually, now her supporters are saying the reason she isn't doing as well is because she's a woman. So, I mean, these candidates, when they don't do well, they or their supporters end up basically, they've already called the Democratic primary voters in these early states racist for not supporting candidates of color. Now they're calling them sexist. And when Pete Buttigieg, if he doesn't win the nomination, if he fails, you can certainly believe that folks in his camp or his supporters are going to say, you know what, the reason he didn't win is because, Democratic voters wouldn't support a gay candidate, which is just not, it's not a good way about going about, unifying your base and electing a candidate. And that's the problem. All these candidates, whoever wins the nomination, you know, if it's Bernie, fine, he'll excite the progressives. But is he going to excite African-Americans? Is he going to excite Latinos? Is he going to excite, you know, older voters? We don't know. There's and they need all those voters, especially in these swing states, if they want to beat Trump. And so I do agree. I don't think it's going to be a blowout one way or the other. I think despite the fact, I think that's what the country really needs at this moment in time. But I think it's going to be close. It's going to be competitive, and it's going to come down to all the same states that we've been paying attention to for the last, 12 years.
One of your writers, Charles Lipson, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, was our guest the other day, and he talked about how, you know, you're mentioning volatility in the bases. He said that it's a function of profound uncertainty economically at a time of great industrial, you know, employment-related change, and that people they're afraid and they don't know where to go and they're kind of nervous about it, and that populism feeds into that, and candidates are looking to take advantage of it.
Look, I think Charles is right, and I don't think you can overestimate where we are today in our politics, how we can draw a straight line from that back to the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. You know, people lost their homes, foreclosures, mortgages. They saw their 401ks obliterated. I mean, it really did rend the fabric of our society in a way that we hadn't seen in a long, long time. And you had all these folks basically in middle America, rural America. They watched folks in Washington and especially on Wall Street not suffering any consequences. Nobody went to jail. Nobody lost their homes. Meanwhile, people on Main Street were losing their homes and their communities were being hollowed out by globalization. And so it was a real turning point. It did induce a lot of fear and anxiety, across a broad swath of the population, which fed directly into sort of this populism, anti-establishment, really anti-elite sentiment that we've seen in the country over the last 10 years or so. And that continues, even though a lot of these folks are now experiencing a bit of a recovery. I mean, wages are up. Blue-collar wages are up faster than white-collar wages. And so there is a sense that the economy has come back, but there's still that lingering, anxiety out there, whether it's the sort of a PTSD-type mentality or, cost of healthcare continue to be a problem, cost of education continue to be a problem for a lot of folks. And so I think they do, even though they're feeling better about the economy and their place in it, there's still some of those fears that are looming out there, and that continues to be a factor in how they vote and who they support.
Yeah, it's one of the things I think people keep forgetting is that people vote against stuff, and there's still a great sentiment in this country against the elites of Washington and the people that tell you how your bathroom is going to be. Your child's bathroom is going to be arranged at school and all sorts of stuff, and they just don't get it. But we'll save that for another.
Can I just add real quickly to that, John?
Yeah.
I mean, that is fundamentally the story of 2016, is that Hillary Clinton was seen as the establishment and one of the elites and one who sort of had a separate set of rules for her and her, family and friends, and Donald Trump was the outsider. And that's the biggest risk the Democrats take by nominating someone like Joe Biden. He's been in Washington for 44 years, and he's going to somehow, change the status quo in Washington. Is not a really realistic. He may reestablish some sort of, sanity or normality or conventionalism to the office of the presidency. But in terms of by Bernie Sanders is much more authentic, speaking much more authentically to that populist strain in the Democratic Party. He says, look, we're going to go in there and we're going to tear things up, reshape it. That's exactly what Donald Trump said, and that's why he won.
And that's why it's a great time to be a journalist writing about this stuff, and it's also a great time to be the editor, the publisher, and co-founder, president of Real Clear Politics. Tom Bevin,
indeed.
Thanks for being here.
You got it, Tom. Thank you.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Tom.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You know, Jeff, talking to Tom Bevan, Real Clear Politics, and to some extent Jason Meisner of the Chicago Tribune, we're seeing, you know, the Madigan piece, the Madigan issue now heats up because of the word rape in the email of Mr. McClain. And that forces the Me Too Democrats who eat at Madigan's table to now take a stand. And on the other side, the on the Democratic Party, you have Joe Biden as one of the consummate insiders whose kid made all that kind of money in Ukraine and China, a wastrel of a young man. And I wouldn't, you know, as a father, you say, oh my God, I don't want that to happen to my son. And as a result, Bernie Sanders is rising as the populist candidate. So people do react, don't they? Isn't that what it's all about, reacting to what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and Tom kind of hit it on there historically, because that's what Tom does and why we love him. But the idea that people in these elections, you know, 2016 was a reactionary election to more of the elitists in Obama and the Clintons, you know, running the country the way they felt was good for everybody, the way they felt we should be living our lives.
Like, quit clinging to your guns and religion, you right. bunch of deplorables.
Right, exactly.
We're going to tell you if a man or woman can be in your daughter's bathroom.
Right, right, exactly. And yeah. and the, even then you roll back to, you know, after the post-Bush, it was Republicans driving us into war, spending all too much money that we'd done on wars that we don't, you know, and not letting the middle class have a fair shake. I mean,
how about war? Go to war and we're going to hollow out your lives.
Right.
Economically. And all our friends in Washington who are making money from China will be writing think tank right. pieces about how great free trade is while you lose your jobs.
Exactly.
So all that people are
right.
fed up.
Going into Iowa, it's a big deal. One of the questions that my mom, you know, my mom, who's is a conservative, and she's, you know, almost always has been. She asked me,
thanks, Mrs. Carlin, for being my friend.
She asked me, you know, why isn't anybody run against Donald Trump? Why isn't there anybody on any of these ballots anywhere? And, you know, why has it never happened? And it was that the conversation we had. I said, well, it's because parties don't really split unless they're reacting to something. I mean, you historically, a party is going to start to tear at itself if it's reacting to something. And the Democrats were seeing that. Some of them are reacting to Trump, but they're obviously all reacting to Trump. But the idea, you know, that they're reacting to what he is not carrying, because there's not enough to go with it. You know, there's not enough to react to it. You had it with the Tea Party movement. It was a reaction to 9/11 and the rights that were, you know, essentially stripped away from us by this idea where we gave the government the security or the ability to look at everything we do. And the Tea Party kind of came out of that idea. And then you did see in that era that there were people trying to run against incumbents or maybe even running for president. But the reaction wasn't strong enough because it didn't touch enough people.
The problem with the Tea Party groups was that they were herded by unscrupulous
right,
actors
yes.
who are Republican operatives. Some of them are now running for president.
Mm-hmm.
Former disc jockeys. Or
right.
something.
Well, and perfect.
On the exactly. Republican side, and it's pathetic. So, yeah, I it's a great time to be a journalist, to write about this stuff. As long as I don't have to stand out on the front lawn of some innocent who's been tagged as, you know, a hateful person by the media mob, like they did to Nick Sandman.
Yeah.
You know. See, stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
people forget. I mean, reporters don't want to deal with it. Reporters would rather, because they'd rather look at the bombshell, whatever that movie is with Charlize Theron.
Right.
They want to see that, you know, hot anchor women dealing with a fat guy who wants to take them to bed.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
They want to, that's where they want to go. But the American public, when they see Richard Jewell,
mm-hmm.
different story.
Yeah.
What else is going on in your mind, on your inner life? What's new in your life, Jeff?
Oh, John, well, a big news for me over the holidays, and we appreciate everybody listening. And I got engaged to Christine. We've been, I think, been together for what have been will be February. It'll be 9 years, so probably about time. We're both pretty excited, really excited.
It's a beautiful picture on your Facebook page, both of you together. She's a lovely young woman, and you're very, you know, you're both of us married up, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, guess, for sure. Yeah. Dancers. We're both marrying up on dancers. So for that, I'm really excited, and a shout out to my parents for giving me the my grandmother's diamond to do it with. So that was a big moment. So did it on Christmas morning, and the best last present of the day, which was one more present, and then I
with everybody around.
Yeah, everybody around. You know,
the families, the kids, everybody together.
My brother and his kids, and my dad, and my sister-in-law, and it was great. It was perfect.
Because marriage is, that's what it's about. It's about family and the generations. And I'm just so excited for you and Christine. And I know everybody listening will give them a warm and happy and loving wishes for your marriage to come.
Yes, absolutely. But don't ask us about a date. That's the one question we're not ready for yet. We don't have a date picked for a wedding.
You know what? I'll ask you next week because time is, you know, what are you going to wait till you're 50 to set the date?
No.
You know, you already waited 9 years to engage, to marry this, to propose. You should have proposed in 2 weeks. Right? So, you know, 9 years. Okay, set a date. My advice, no fancy downtown hotel. Banquet hall is good, or maybe a church hall or something.
Yeah, we've got a couple ideas. We'll see. We'll pick a date.
Right, and of course you can all. I'll bring the Metropolitan of, you know, the Greek Orthodox. You can convert to the true and true. That way you can talk about Catholics and Protestants as heretics because they all are. No, I'm just joking, my Protestant and Catholic friends. Or Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokon show on WGN. For Jason Meisner, the federal building reporter for the Chicago Tribune on Madigan and what's to come. And for Tom Bevan, my good friend, co-founder, publisher, president of Real Clear Politics. Sometimes they run my column on their site. They ran my last Sunday's column on their site. But you know what? I like him whether he does that or not, because his insights to me are valuable. And to all of you who listen to us, look, we're not getting paid to do this. We do it just to talk to you, and we love it. So find us on iTunes, write us a kick-ass review, because, you know, this is the Chicago way, and we'll give you a bribe, maybe a fencing contract or maybe asphalt once I'm mayor. We really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us. See us next time on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN+.